Hi, I'm Steph.
And I'm Jules.
And welcome to
The Babesment. Steph is a body positive photographer.
And Jules is an intuitive eating and body image coach.
And we have both dedicated our lives to empowering women to own their bodies and themselves so that they can live their biggest lives.
And now we want to welcome you into these powerful conversations.
So join us as we hear from women and anyone working through and overcoming struggles in their bodies.
We are inspired daily by the lives they live, and we can't wait to share their empowering life lessons with you.
Hey, Steph.
Hey, Jules.
Hey, Steph.
Hey, Jules. Okay. We're back in the basement.
We are back in the basement.
It's not the podcast unless Julie really has her little variety hour. So,
ooh, do we have the pre-election day episode for you?
Seriously, this episode is fire.
It's so good. It's so good. We have two absolute badass change makers on the podcast today. We have Caroline Wolliver, who is the Director of Leadership and Social Justice at the YWCA Columbus. And we have the wonderful Lauren James, who is the Leadership and Social Justice Program Manager. And if, in case y'all didn't know, the YWCA's mission is casually to eliminate racism, empower women, promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all.
Casual.
Casual.
I am so fired up and inspired by the conversation that we had with Caroline and Lauren. I mean, this intro could go on forever just talking about all of the things we hit on, but talking about our own roles in our own communities and social justice and activism, how body liberation is a social justice movement, and how we can all feel like we already have the power in ourselves to be a part of these movements. Plus, both of their own stories are phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
I just can't tell you guys how hyped I am for you to hear this interview. So I'm going to shut up and let the interview do it for itself.
And although we're going to say this multiple times in the episode, as if you're listening to this app on Monday, the day it comes out, November 2nd.
And you have not yet
voted.
Go vote.
Go vote.
Go team. Go vote.
Go vote.
Go vote so that we can still like America.
Oh, so that our anxiety can just subside a little bit.
So that we can take a fucking nap.
So that, like, 2020 can have a bright, shining light.
I would love to take a nap in Joe Biden's America.
I would love that.
Wouldn't you love that?
I would love to take a nap in Kamala Harris's America.
Mm, yes, that too. I would take a nap in either one of their Americas.
All right, y'all. Let's not nap yet.
It's not nap time yet, but hopefully soon. But before that, here is today's episode.
Now, hi, everybody. We are back in the Babesment. We have two guests. Actually, I think it's the first time we've ever had two guests on Zoom.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's actually very true.
So welcome to both Caroline and Lauren from the YWCA of Columbus. We are so excited to have you both on The Babesment.
Yay. Thank you so much for having us. We are equally excited and also very honored to be your first double Zoom feature. So thank you for that.
And you guys were telling us before we started recording that it's your very first podcast. So what? We are honored that it's your first. Hopefully the first of many, because from what I already know about you both, you are two pretty badass people who deserve all the podcast platforms in the world. So cheers to being the first of many.
Yes. And, you know, we are very much both avid podcast consumers, Lauren especially so. So we are very excited about this, kind of fangirling out because we also love your podcast.
Oh my gosh. You guys, why don't we start real quick by having you both just give a brief little introduction of like who you are and what you do and all that good stuff.
Okay. Lauren, you want to take us away?
Yeah. So my name is Lauren James. I am the Leadership and Social Justice Program Manager at YWCA Columbus. So I guess what I do essentially is help to manage our programs that are centered around providing leadership training for women in our community and just providing the community with education on how to get involved with efforts to make our world more socially equitable. So we cover a lot of stuff, but our mission at the YWCA is to eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, dignity, and freedom for all. So like those are the bases we cover.
Just like casually.
Just like super casual.
Super casually. Like, I mean,
just a couple of things.
Just a big deal at all, you know?
No.
That's incredible.
That's seriously amazing. Y'all, this is why we are so excited to have Lauren and Caroline. Like, hi.
And I am Caroline Wolliver. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And I am a social change champion and connector at heart and have the incredible privilege of serving as the Director of Leadership and Social Justice at YWCA Columbus and get to work with Lauren and such amazing other women to really try to make our community a better place for all of its residents. And, you know, as I'm sure that we'll get into it later, but for YWCA Columbus, you know, we really try to take a threefold approach to producing social change. And so Lauren and I and our department really is just one of those three buckets. So we'll be happy to share about how we work to empower future leaders and really build community consensus. But YWCA Columbus does a lot of things. We have our hands in many cookie jars. So if you don't know us, we'd be honored for you to check us out.
Oh, so great.
Amazing.
So great. So without further ado, let's dive into our first question.
Our classic first
our
question.
Classic first question.
So here on the Babes Mint, we always like to start with the first question, whichever of you would like to answer first can. But can you tell us a little bit about what your relationship with your body was like when you were young?
Sure. You know, I personally was always pretty fairly athletic growing up and found my body to be more of a vessel for, playing sports and things like that, but felt really incredibly insecure about my body growing up, especially about my thighs. In fact, Lauren and I recently were talking about how I'm still like unlearning a lot of the stuff that was so ingrained in me growing up. I found in my family, we have some real generational shame about our Robinson thighs. And I can't tell you how many times that I tried on tight pants and my mom said I looked like I had been, quote, melted and poured into them.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a Southern phrase or just something
that
my
Italian grandmother would have said that.
Yes. So, as far as my growing up, my mom was almost always on a diet. And I found myself doing the same thing. You know, I remember at this horrible memory in sixth grade, she was on a 2-week grapefruit and egg diet where you really can't eat anything other than what was on a specific menu. And I think you end up eating like 64 eggs in 2 weeks, which is gross enough by itself.
It's just eggs.
64 eggs in 2 weeks. And like I'm an egg person. I mean, I eat 2 eggs most mornings, but like
64 eggs.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That's an upsetting amount of eggs.
I tried to participate with her and I got to like day 2 and went to a friend's house that had popcorn. And I remember having this distinct memory of chewing up the popcorn and like sneakily trying to spit it out so that I could technically stay compliant with the diet. And I could not have been more than like 10 or 11.
Oh my God.
And yeah. And, you know, already really developing unhealthy ways of, you know, restricting food to lose weight. And it wasn't until the last few years that my mom and I actually started having discussions about our own body image issues. And she felt really strongly that a lot of her own body dysmorphia and shame was learned through messages that she received from her mom. Mm-hmm. And looked at me and said, you know, I really hope that I didn't do any of this to you. And so it's really interesting to consider how body image issues, you know, obviously reinforced by culture and the media, but can actually be just passed down through generations without really any kind of awareness of how you've enabled that dysfunction to persist. So, you know, I think now as an adult, I'm certainly not immune to self-criticism, but I also really recognize the freedom that comes with that idea of self-love and authenticity. And, you know, while I still am working on unlearning some of those immediate habits, ironically, my wife says my thighs are her favorite part of my body, and yes. I have come to learn to love them too.
Yes, snaps for that. There's just so much truth to what you just said, and we both resonate so much with your story. And I mean, in my family, it's the joke is the Lass ass. My mom's like maiden name was Lass, and like, there's some big hips and big butts on that side of the family. And I definitely also have that. And they would always make, you know, jokes and, you know, kind of talk about the last ass. And as I've, you know, been doing this work, I forget when it was. We were all together with my aunts and stuff. And I'm like, no more talking about the last ass. Like, it's a bad thing. I have it too, y'all. And I refuse to say that it's a bad thing. And I was like, yes. Foot down, no more. Like, let's embrace the last ass, okay?
Love it. That's a great hashtag.
Oh, I love that. But it's so true that, you know, a lot of our learned body beliefs are very generational, and it's very much handed down from mother to daughter. And so it's something that we've talked about a lot, that we know, like, you know, the big piece of my story is, you know, my mom taking me to Weight Watchers when I was in the fifth grade and stuff like that. And I know she came from such a place of love, but it also had very negative impacts on me that lasted for a very long time. And it's important. I think that's a big reason why we have this podcast now, why we do the work we do, is because we want everybody to realize how much it's on us to like break those cycles, you know?
Yeah. And you're providing an alternative way of thinking, right? So there is, you know, so much pressure put on young girls, especially girls, that to look a certain way, to behave a certain way. And especially around body image, just knowing that there are local women that are just kind of everyday people that are highlighting this issue and providing some alternatives. It's really exciting.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. It is. It's both a responsibility, like it's both like a challenge, right? Like it's not easy to do all the unlearning that like we're doing that you're talking about, you know? And so it's a responsibility, but it's also, wow, what a privilege it is that like we can do this work and that we, you know, are being exposed to conversation. Like we came to this because someone else taught us this stuff. You know what I mean? And so it's like, we're being open to this new way of thinking about our bodies and about body diversity and how real it is and how we can hopefully then break that generational cycle. You know, like that's my greatest hope, that if I have kids and, you know, whether I have a boy or a girl or non-binary, like, you know, whoever I have as a child, like, I hope that, you know, they have a different experience than me, you know, and have a much more wonderful connected relationship with their bodies and, you know, knowing their worth from the get-go and not questioning or tying their worth to their bodies. So it's like, it's both like a blessing and a curse, right? Because we have to do the work, which is really hard to do. But hopefully, you know, there's amazing fruits of doing this work down the line. Mm-hmm. Oh, love it. Lauren, how about you?
Oh, yeah. So I love what you're saying too. And I feel like the intentionality behind doing the work is the difference maker, because Caroline, I really relate too. And I think one of you guys said it too, where your mom has that like pretty much instilled a lot of, you know, that going on when it comes to the way you view your body and just not accepting it, but also like expressing a sentiment of you, like, I really hope you don't feel that way. And you're like, well, like there was a huge disconnect between like the communication and what you hope for right now. And so I feel like the difference maker like is like really doing the work within yourself, because it really takes doing the intentional work. So when you get to that place of being a mother or just anyone influencing the younger generation, like those deeper like feelings and beliefs, like, are what you want to communicate because they come out. So yeah, my story with my body when I was growing up was just your typical, like, complete lack of acceptance, like, you know, patriarchy, what we're conditioned to do to fully not accept our bodies. So I always had a smaller frame, but yeah, middle school and whatnot, I just, like, probably middle school until, like, mid-college, just, like, never okay with the fact that I have any fat on my stomach at all. I'm like, there should be none there. Like, why is this a thing? So yeah, I feel like, yeah, working that back and shedding that has been a thing. And then I think, like, yeah, I think just, like, also I think walking through the world in my skin as an African-American woman, that was very difficult. I had a big transition from elementary school to being in predominantly Black environment to going to a predominantly white environment where, like, I was no longer the norm. And that was really, like, that rocked me a lot. So I think, like, trying to figure out, like, accepting, like, that I, you know, me being different than what my norm or what was normal around me was, like, you know, something that I could accept and that the world would accept too, I think took a lot, but we're here now. So yeah.
Yes. It's, I resonate a lot with that piece on, like, I thought, like, I shouldn't have any belly fat. It's like, we're painted this picture of this such extreme thin body that, like, it's also often photoshopped, right? Mm-hmm. So that then we have these completely ridiculous expectations for our own bodies. And that's why we see, like, even people that have, like, are in a smaller frames. Like, I was also in a smaller frame growing up and all of that. And I was like, why do I have belly fat? You know, it's like, I don't know, because you're human. And, like, we have belly fat. And that's, like, the most normal thing ever. And yet we're taught at such a young age to demonize it. Because what do we see at the grocery store, right? Like, every magazine, like, blast belly fat in these five ways. And it's like, even just from those little headlines, boom, we learn as kids, oh, belly fat is terrible. I gotta blast belly fat in these ways, you know, which is so wrong.
Like, amazing. And then that is the kind of shit that leads to, like, an egg diet. Like,
an egg and grapefruit.
I'm still really reeling from the egg and grapefruit thing.
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah, you have like a half of a grapefruit every morning for breakfast and lunch and then dinner and snack. And then you have, like, steaks and eggs. And that was pretty much it. And
that's,
I'm like,
I'm
a vegetarian. So I'm like, I could, like, literally couldn't eat that diet now, nor would anybody ever want to. Like,
No. Oh, like
you putting yourself through that just to, like, shed a few pounds, like, in an unhealthy way. Horrible.
It reminds me of, there was that one that, like, resurfaced that was, like, from the 50s or 60s, the diet where you, like, ate a hard-boiled egg and then basically drank, like, two bottles of white wine throughout the day. And they're like, you'll be fine. This is totally a fine diet. I'm like, they're fine because they're wasted every day.
Yeah.
And not, right, asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my God, these diets. I just, like, and it's so wild too, because I can totally imagine and believe the world in which, like, you know, me as a child, like, my mother, like, a friend's mother would have been on an egg and grapefruit diet and nobody really would have questioned it. And I sit here now and I'm like, what the actual fuck?
Yeah.
Totally. Like, why grapefruit? Like,
there would have been some sort of, like, secret to the way, like, all of the acids in your body basically just, like, burning you alive. I don't really know.
Like, I have a very sensitive tongue. And my tongue would have been, like, not okay with that much grapefruit.
I have a lot of problems with this whole scenario.
So many.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
So many. Yeah. I'm curious too, Lauren, like, what an experience to go from, like, what you described, was it middle school to high school, where you were like, yeah, I was surrounded by people like me, like, a Black community, and then went to high school where now all of a sudden it was, you know, mostly white. Like, what was that like for you? Like, tell us more about how, like that shifting identity and how you navigated that.
Yeah. So it was actually elementary to middle school, okay. I feel like an even more jarring transition.
Absolutely.
Middle school is
of everything terrible.
You could not pay me enough money to go back to middle school. No way.
Never. Never. Yeah, so it was really rough. And like, not only was it going from like predominantly African-American environment to a lot of white people, it was also like moving out to the suburbs, so that whole thing. And I heard a lot of direct messaging. Like, this is right around the time when it's like, you start to realize boys and you're like, oh my God, boys. And I heard a lot of messaging directly from boys that I would never date a black girl. I would never be with a black girl. You know, black girls are not like, so I think that created a lot of like issues in me. Like, and I think too, a lot of the messages I heard growing up as well is like, your body and the way you look and your attractiveness is essential for getting a boy, you know? And right. So it just became like this whole thing of like, I don't know how to adjust to this new reality where like people are telling me like, oh, who you are is not desirable to us. And it's not normal anymore because you're in this completely white space. And so, yeah, it was a lot. Like, I was like, this is a lot.
Like, we're all young, but like, I feel like we're all around the same age, I'm guessing. Like, just by like,
looking at us.
Like, we're all like around the same age. And like, I think people often, I don't think fully recognize, at least like white people, I feel like don't often recognize how like the, in these ways that racism is like still very here, even though it's like, that was probably what, like in the 2000s, right? Like, this very blatant racism, right? Still happening, like even in the year, in the 2008, you know what I mean? And I think, so thank you for like sharing that story, because I think it's really powerful to see how it's still at play. And it's like, when we're kids and, you know, in terms of just like anything with, you know, our bodies and being bullied around whatever it is about how we look, you know, of course, as kids, then we take this to be like, oh my gosh, I'm wrong, right? Like, I don't measure up to what I need to look like in order to, you know, be worthy and fall in love and like be successful. You know, and we process that in that way when we're young, right? We're like, oh my God, they called me this name. That means I'm this. And we make all these meanings. And then, of course, now as adults, we can look back and be like, well, obviously that those kids were just like fucking idiots, right? Like, you don't want them anyways. Like, that's their shit. Like, hi, like, bye. But as kids, obviously, that's not how we process it, you know? And so it's so interesting to look at the experience we have when we're young and how we, you know, take on those things. And then when we're older, we can look back and be like, oh my God, like, let's reframe here. Like, obviously, those are just assholes who I don't want in my life anyways. Like, goodbye.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. But in middle school, especially, I know it's like every word is so deeply ingrained in you. And to have that experience too, where, you know, from my own experience of living in a larger body at that point in my life and being like, boys will never like me because I am fat or whatever. But to compound something like your race, the color of your skin, and feel so wrong and just exactly who you are and who you were born to be is so deeply like painful for me to think about, and to think about these kids who just are like being asshole kids, but to understand that like there's really serious deep like racism and oppression and shit in those words that those boys learned to share with you.
Yeah. And we also think about it, or we don't think about it often as explicitly when it's kind of codified into our institutions and to our cultures. I mean, even thinking about like very racist, white centered norms about quote unquote professionalism and like hair. And it's just, you know, truly important for every individual, especially people in leadership positions, to really take a look at the policies and the culture of an organization, and really critically examine the ways that you are enabling those racist systems to persist, whether it's explicit or a little bit more covert, because it still has real damage that is done.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Abso-freaking-lutely. So how would you guys then, if, you know, we talked about kind of, you know, your relationship with your bodies when you were younger. And then how would you describe your relationship with your bodies today and like with yourselves today? Like, how has that changed? How has that evolved for you guys?
Yeah. You know, I think a couple things came to mind immediately when I thought about this question. I think that for me, I think of a couple of different things, stages in my life. You know, when I came out as queer, it was also, I had just watched The L Word, and there was an episode in there where they talk about how to identify or spot a lesbian, and like how there were very specific markers. And so I remember even myself, I'm very femme, and you know, even thinking about like, oh, well, I can't paint my nails anymore. And like, I've got to like butch it up so people can spot me. Right? And so even that, like a physical representation of other people's perception of sexuality was a very interesting kind of transition for me, going from that to then again, just like living who I am and not trying to necessarily mark myself or not mark myself, you know, just living who I am. But then also, you know, a few years ago, I was getting ready to be married, and I lost a lot of weight, really without doing anything to lose it, which is absolutely not normal for me. And it turns out my body was sick. I had an undiagnosed autoimmune disorder, and a common symptom for people during oftentimes an initial flare-up is significant weight loss. And so while I was feeling really good the compliments that I was getting, you know, I was feeling physically really awful. And with my diagnosis, it really allowed me to kind of reevaluate my relationship with my body and my overall health. I think now, for example, I'm much more grateful for my body's functionality. And I am intentional about really taking care to nurture it. And, you know, I think that for me also knowing that my symptoms and pain are degenerative and will continue to worsen over time. And so really trying to be as intentional as I can about how I care for it has been really important. And then just feeling grateful that I have the functionality that I do and trying to sustain that as much as I can.
It's so powerful. Like these, so much of what you just said, I like want to like unpack and dive into. Because the first piece, the story about like, oh my gosh, I can't like wear nail polish. Like I mean, like butch it up. It's like, there's so much that we are taught, right? That we're like, we're programmed to invest in terms of how others perceive us, right? And we put all of our focus in, well, how is somebody else perceiving me? And how should I be perceived? How do I hope that they perceive me? You know, and then trying to dress ourselves or act in these ways so that they might perceive me in this way. I mean, that was totally me. All I cared about was like, well, how are they seeing? I mean, that's totally what drove my disordered eating, right? Was like, oh my God, I better be skinny so that they think I'm like healthy and successful. It's like, what the fuck? You know, like you can now see how totally awful that was. But it all came back to how are people seeing me, you know, and what judgments are they making about me? And it's like, oh my God, we place so much there and it's so damaging, right? And we feel like we have to follow these rules. It's like, whose rules and why? Like, said who? Like, you want to wear a nail polish? Wear a nail polish. Like, you want to have a pixie cut? Have a pixie cut. You want to do what? Like, it's like, it's just, it's wild how we're just taught so young, right? To like follow these arbitrary rules.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think, you know, within respective identities, you know, there are norms within each type of identity, and then how that interacts with overall, I think, like more like consistent white, straight, wealthy, able-bodied kind of normative culture. It's really interesting to try to critically think about how there are intentional norm breaking or following within identities, and then how that intersects with other norms in general.
Mm. Fascinating. Yeah. It's also fascinating. And then this other piece that you were saying that I wanted to, oh my gosh, now I'm blanking.
About when you were getting married.
Oh, yeah.
And you dropped a significant amount of weight without trying, which turned out to be from having an undiagnosed autoimmune disorder.
That was a great summary. Thank you, by the way.
Thank you.
You were listening.
I was listening. Thank you. But I think it's so important. You know, you mentioned you were getting ready to be married and you were getting a lot of compliments, which felt really good. But actually, physically, your body was not feeling good. And I think that's such an important thing to pause on, because we know that, you know, this was very true for me, was that compliments fed my eating disorder and very much fed, like, I was very unhappy, but I felt the need for that praise. But I think it's such an important lesson that we can talk about, is why praising weight loss is not something that should be a norm, is not, you know, it's not a compliment to tell somebody that they look great because they've lost weight, because you may not know the reasoning behind it. They may not know yet the reasoning behind it. You know, it can be something like being, like having an illness. It can be something like even it could have been the stress of whatever you were going through in your life at that time. It can be because of a loss. It can be because of so many various things, in addition to being because of eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for, you know, for people to understand that, like, we know that people mean generally like the best by telling us like how good we look, but it can be really hard or really harmful to share those types of comments.
And I think also on top of that, it's like, even all those things aside, right? When we're complimenting people on having a smaller body, we're saying, oh, smaller bodies are better. And now you're better because you're in a smaller body. Because I was the same way, right? When I was spiraling in my... And it was funny, I gave a talk at my alma mater last night and I was thinking back on my story and sharing my story with them. And I had lost a significant amount of weight on purpose, a lot through binging and purging. Not great. And I had gone back to school my sophomore year. And I can remember that like first night out, you know, on campus. And I can even remember the dress I was wearing. And I can, it was like, it's like burned, the memories I don't have, right? And then the ones that I do, I'm like, what the, like, really?
But I had
but I had this distinct memory of all the compliments. It's like, oh my God, you're so skinny. Look at you. You look so amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're also learning, okay, how I was before wasn't good. You know, like how I was before wasn't good enough. I'm better now. And meanwhile, I was like vomiting, you know? And so like at the end of the day, okay, Maple just
had to come get all up
she
in.
She just like crawled over and was like, hi, mom, I gotta sit here. Oh, geez. I need like, so anyway, casual 95 pound
dog.
She's a 95 pound lap dog.
Okay. Anyways, though, but yeah, the bottom line is that any compliment, right, around weight loss is always a compliment saying, oh, smaller bodies are better than bigger bodies, which is in itself a really harmful message, right? Because we know how real body diversity is, and that, you know, placing thinner bodies higher on the ladder is not okay.
Yeah.
And anyone around us also hears that. And then, you know, they learn that too, right? So it hurts everybody in earshot.
Yeah. And I know that, at least for me, that, that momentary flare up was also not sticking around, you know? So like all of those messages that you get, but then when you're, you know, your body starts to rebound and the weight is starting to come back, then it's like, well, what does that do to your self-esteem if you have internalized those messages about looking better, when you were a smaller size? Yeah.
Right. Right. It's so damaging. And we know too, like, say someone even lost the weight because of dieting, right? We know that 98% of people are going to regain it, and that 60% will regain more than they started with. And so then not only do they feel like a failure, even though they're not, because that's just, it's just biology taking over, but it's made even worse because people praised us so much for having lost the weight. And then we're like, oh my God, what a failure I am because I gained the weight back. Now I'm not as pretty and lovable and, you know, valuable. It's such a spiral.
Yeah, totally.
Mm. It's so crazy because it doesn't actually make sense. Like, it's capitalism. Like, It's like they yep. realize you make a lot of money with all this weight loss stuff. Like, and, but if you really think about it, like you see people of all different sizes and they really will be attracted to you. Like, I don't know. Like, and like, it's crazy. It's yeah. But I totally relate to that, Caroline. This is funny. Our department is like, has a lot of us with autoimmune disorders.
We're cursed.
Really, we've hired some new people and we're just like, please just, you know, visit your doctor. Like,
Do you need to see a rheumatologist?
Yes, really.
My dad's a rheumatologist. I know a good one.
Cool. That's awesome.
He's an Akron.
For me, my birthday is tomorrow.
Oh, happy birthday!
Exciting. But last year on my birthday, I got confirmation at the doctor's that I had an autoimmune disorder. And a little bit after that, found out that I had lupus. And so this has been a year for me. And my relationship with my body has really become so different. The luxuries of like, am I cute? Like, do I feel like I'm like looking cute? Like that is like not even the main body story for me anymore. So it is really tough. It comes with like debilitating pain. Mm. And there were moments when I could barely walk. Caroline knows I could barely stand up. It comes with a lot of joint stuff for me. And also with those things, it can really be exacerbated by stress / brought on by stress. Mm-hmm. And so when you have flare-ups and whatnot, so my, like, I've had this tantrum of like, it's not fair that I can't be unhealthy with my lifestyle of like busyness anymore, because it's gotten so bad that it's now physically, I'm having physical repercussions, and I'm like, that's not fair. I want to continue to be unhealthy with the amount of stuff that I do.
And I want to be busy. I feel that.
Yeah.
And so that has just completely changed my whole world. Like I just truly can't live the way that I used to, which is good. I think like the body was the last stop for like something that like, for me mentally, like I was not living in a healthy way for myself, just like self-care and whatnot. And my body was the last stop. I said, enough, like this is no more. So it's been a hard lesson to learn, but a liberating one. So yeah, I'm very grateful. Now it's just like, I'm not like, let me not eat gluten because, you know, that like can add some pounds. It's like, you will feel it in your fingers like the next day. So that's been a rude awakening, I think, for sure. Yeah.
It definitely offers a whole different perspective, mm-hmm. right? From having the body story being predominantly around how do I look and am I measuring up to society's, you know, awful standards and being pretty in their eyes to, oh my gosh, I have these autoimmune conditions happening and I'm in pain and I have to really adjust how I live my life to support my body in a way that's going to be as helpful as possible.
Yeah, it's
quite a shift.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's like, it totally just, I don't know, it goes back to that, like, we should be looking at our bodies in order to, like, I don't know, like that body and mental health connection, it really all is just one flow. And so, mm-hmm. and like, if you can be okay with like your body, like that's speaking to the fact that your like mental health is at a good place, and like then your body health is going to be at a good place because you're not, you know, trying to kill yourself with diets or whatever, do the whole thing. And it really is, the body and the mind are so connected on that level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's so, yeah, that's so important because you're right. Like mental health, emotional health, physical health, they all go together. Even then we add in things like, you know, financial health or career health or spiritual health or, you know, like relational health, like all these different areas, right, of our lives make up our overall health. They all play a role because I think really at the core of what you were saying, like stress
mm-hmm.
is at the yeah. core of like all of those things.
Yeah. And if you're somebody who then feels like guilt or shame about what you're eating, for example, you know, we're just packing on layers of additional stress and just like things that we don't have to feel yet. We're kind of adding it onto ourselves subconsciously. And that's definitely one thing that I have tried to change since my diagnosis too, is like definitely, you know, I'll intentionally try to eat things that reduce inflammation just so that I'm more comfortable. But like I have totally also given up the idea of like guilt eating. Like I'll eat what I want to eat and feel fine about it and just be yes. like, I really enjoyed that. Like
yes.
that gave me some great joy. Yes. I don't know if that's healthy or not, but like
it
I enjoyed
it. Is.
And
it, is.
Like, yeah.
It is. It's so important to understand that like eating is both yes for physical like feeling good, but also is like food is such a connector. It's such an emotional experience. It can really bring serious comfort in hard times, I know. And how lucky are we to have food to do that for us, to be there for us during hard times. But also like we just got to give ourselves a little bit of a fucking break when it comes to food, because it shouldn't be, we put a lot of shit onto food that food does not deserve. Right?
We really do. And also like there's so much beauty too in terms of food. Like I had a client who was like, oh my gosh, as she's like making peace with food, she goes, I made this wonderful like tomato sauce and pasta that like my grandmother used to make. And so there's these really beautiful like familial like foods, you know, that we can pass down. And what a gorgeous way to like be connected to our family and like generations yeah. past. Like it's, food is special and it should be special. And we should get to eat it with so much joy, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had another client today who, you know, speaking of like the guilt that we place on food and ourselves, you know, we're working through intuitive eating and, you know, honoring our hunger and honoring our fullness. And like, you know, part of that, like we're going to eat past the point of fullness. Like we're going to. And you don't fail intuitive eating when you eat past the point of fullness. Like, hi, we're human. And it might happen yeah. accidentally, or maybe you choose it. And like, either way, it's fine. Like, it's really okay. And we were like talking about like the guilt that she felt the last time it happened. And I'm like, hey, are you still here? She's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, so you're still like breathing, like your heart's still beating, like you're fine, right? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, so like, it's really not that big of a deal, right? Like, let's back up and realize like, oh my God, if we eat past the point of fullness, like it's really okay. Like, yeah. we're
the
not-
The world is not gonna end.
The world's
end.
Not gonna end. Like, we're not gonna all of a sudden die. Like, we're really okay. And yet, how many of us feel such deep guilt and stress and doom when it happens? It's like
the most impending doom.
It's like, oh my God, you guys, like we didn't like hurt somebody. We didn't go like rob a bank or like we didn't commit a crime. Like we just ate a little too much food. Like, okay, it's going to be all right, you know? But our culture teaches us it's like the worst thing we can do mm-hmm. is eat past the point of fullness. It's like, no, it's really okay. Like let's not place more stressors on us. Like as you were saying, there are plenty of things to be stressed out about. Especially in 2020,
yeah,
and life in general, plenty of things that like are legitimate stressors. Let's not add things to our plate that we don't need to be stressed out about, like eating.
Yeah.
And we like the world tells us to, and we just let it completely overshadow all of the amazing things. It's like you could be like a doctor, like amazing, like taking care of your family and like blah, blah, all this amazing stuff. But you're like, but I overate, so I feel very bad about myself. It's like, can we just like focus on like all of the rest of how you are so amazing? Like, and yeah, it's just, it's so ingrained. It's so hard to get away from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We can let that override everything else. Like another client of mine recently was like, had a breakthrough. And she was like, wait a minute. I do all of these other things so well. And my mental health is like, oh my God, I worked so hard. I'm so proud of my mental health. So proud of what I'm doing in my career. I'm so proud of like my relationships and like all these areas of her life. She was like, I am so proud of the work I put into these areas. And they're so healthy and wonderful. And just so what? So what that like the one area I happen to struggle with is like my physical health. Like, so that's okay. Like, yeah. I do really well these other things. And like, why am I letting this one little area, you know, and being my hardship overshadow all the other amazing things? Like, these things are really important too. Like, yeah. And yeah, she's working on, you know, healing that relationship with her body physically, right? But she had let that overshadow everything else when she was like, wait, these other things matter a lot. Why was I doing that? I'm like, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would love to transition our conversation into talking about the work that you guys do at the YWCA and like really like talking about social justice and leadership and why having women in these arenas are so important. Like, let's just get into it. Why is it so important? Tell us about what you guys do and the impact of this work.
Sure. Well, I'll share, I guess, a little brief little elevator speech, if you will, about YWCA, kind of the way that we approach the work and then how our specific department helps to complete the mission. So as Lauren said, our YWCA Columbus works to eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity. And we do this by, again, like kind of three buckets. So we work to treat the symptoms of poverty, specifically through housing supportive services. So we operate our YWCA Family Center, which currently has about 50 up to 60 potential families who are experiencing homelessness, as well as our downtown building, which houses 91 formerly homeless women with a diagnosed physical or mental disability. And then we also work to do a lot of advocacy and public policy work. So we are kind of treating the symptoms and then we're working on preventing it through legislation and working with a variety of different connections within local government to try to do things like, for example, declare racism as a public health crisis, which just was done both in Franklin County and the city of Columbus.
Yes.
So we're a big, proud partner of that. And then we also do a lot of programming related to social justice. And that's really where we come in. And well, I guess we also have a social enterprise related to children's programming. So we have a before and after school program for working families. But then as far as our leadership and social justice department is concerned, we are really the social justice advocacy arm and building community consensus. So, you know, we know that treating the symptoms of poverty and advocating for a policy change isn't going to be enough to produce substantive social change without building community consensus. So what we try to do is we work to inform the community and empower emerging leaders to become social change agents so that we can have a bigger ripple effect in the community on advancing social change than what we'd be able to have on our own. And so we have several different programs. And then depending on the year, we also will have a variety of initiatives. So like this year, we're doing a lot with civic engagement, with helping to reach what was considered hard to count populations for the census, and a huge get out the vote effort. But we also run our signature programs for women. We have a program that actually just opened called Leadership for Social Change. The application process just opened up and it's through November 20th. So if you are a woman who is interested in advancing social change and advancing equity in your communities, definitely check out our website and apply.
So cool.
It's amazing. Like we have local community experts that teach about community organizing and board service, running for office.
I want to really understand. We should do this.
Sign me up.
Yes, please. You know, it's a very special program, and the participants go on to do really incredible things, where they themselves are able to influence change within their respective organizations and neighborhoods. And then we also have a program that is like Leadership for Social Change, but for middle school girls. So it's called
Yes!
Bright Futures.
I love that.
Yes, Lauren is actually leading a graduation this evening for one of our first ever virtual Bright Futures class. So that program specifically works with middle school girls in their local neighborhood. So we're partnering with local community centers so that we can really be as accessible to girls who are living in under-resourced neighborhoods with high youth vulnerability. And so what we try to do is go into the neighborhoods, build authentic relationships with community members, with partners in those neighborhoods, so that it's not just us coming in and saying, we know best and let us tell you what to do, but really a collaborative relationship building experience. And then we teach young girls to really understand and question and disrupt oppressive systems, advocating for themselves and other people, creating confidence so that they can create change within their neighborhoods and, you know, stand up for what's right. So it's a really exciting opportunity for us to work with women kind of at all ages throughout their own social justice journeys. And they all go on and do different things in different ways, depending on, you know, what resonates with them. And so even that authentic engagement and change is such an important piece of what we do.
Oh man, I'm so fired up about all of that.
This is so cool. This is, I mean, seriously. And you like spoke a lot to my heart, because I, before I started my own like coaching business, I worked for Columbus Public Health. And one of my really good friends there was one of the policy directors. And we would just totally always geek out about, you know, health policy and like all that stuff. And so I was just like, oh my God, yeah, like that's so cool. Like all the policy work. And then, but it's so neat how you guys are approaching this from such a multifaceted way, right? Like it's not just policy. It's like, no, let's get in there. Let's empower the community. And oh, this is, it's just awesome.
Hey friends, Steph here. I know you've heard us talk a ton about My Goddess Sessions, and maybe you've been thinking it's something you want to do for yourself, but you're not totally sure yet. I'm here to let you know that the time is now. You don't have to wait for anything to come celebrate yourself. At my very last Goddess Session, my client was so nervous to do this, which most of us are. It's a new experience. It's something you have invested a lot of time and energy and money into for yourself. But as soon as she got in there and we started taking photos and she saw herself in the back of the camera, she saw the truth of her own body and her own spirit, she opened up and she was free. And I want that freedom for every single one of us. So if you're ready, please come do a Goddess Session with me. You can fill out the application on my website, stephstrebphoto.com. And I can't wait to see you and have you join the Goddess Gang. So incredible. I mean, I love that not only are you working to create these programs to help empower, like, you know, young women and people who are already like adults to get involved in these things, but also starting with middle school age girls, especially the fire and passion in a middle school girl, if it can be harnessed into something, is like, I am a volunteer camp counselor for Flying Horse Farms, which is a camp for kids with serious illnesses here in Ohio. I'm very actively involved in them, but I'm always with these like 13-year-old girls. And I'm just like, you all are so incredible if it just wasn't for middle school. But but I love so much that you're empowering these young people to really see themselves as like forces for change. I think that's such an incredible thing to do. So, you know, most of our listener base is young women. What are some of the things that you see that like that hold women back from stepping into working in social activism or social justice, and how can we help them feel empowered to step into these spaces?
Yeah. Well, I just spoke, Lauren. You wanna talk a little bit, and I can jump in as needed.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I want to say before I answer that too. So you guys just had Stephanie Hanna on, and she is awesome. She spoke with our Leadership for Social Change cohort last week. Yeah. So I was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. Yeah.
And she just rolled off our board. So that's she's amazing. Well connected in the YW family.
We loved Stephanie. Her interview was awesome. And we are super excited. By the time this interview comes out, we will have gotten to vote for her already.
Yeah. But so I think what holds young women back is just, I mean, there's a lot. I think in activism, in general, like there's a lot that you can do, but I think that we often just like what there is to do is not communicated a lot of times. I think it sometimes feels like hard to access knowledge. Like, how do I actually make change? I mean, you see like the like real big like community organizers who are like, you know, starting the protests and stuff like that, that feels very far off when in actuality, like anyone has the power to do that. It's just about deciding to do it and like recognizing that you have a ton of people who feel the same way and want to join you. So I think that's a huge part of it too. I mean, obviously there's so many like just barriers in general for women, just like being in spaces and things of that nature. So I think that's a part of it too. But I think like representation as well, I think like, especially I feel like Bright Futures is so awesome because to one see like to be a girl and then to be a young girl and to really believe like I really have power right now to make a difference, like not when I'm older, like currently is huge, but it's so accurate, but it's something that you may not really see as a young girl. We just did our Bright Futures session on community organizing and we showed them videos of girls their age organizing like the climate strike and all that thing and all things like that. And we just really tried to hit home that message, like not like you could be, like you currently are powerful, like very powerful. Like there are girls your age doing a lot more for the environment right now than like a ton of us adults are doing. And truly, thank you, dear God, for the youth. So I feel like really just, I think a lot of times it's really powerful when we can just see that we can do those things. And so the representation is huge, definitely. Yeah.
And I think, you know, storytelling is incredibly important. And I love that you emphasize, Lauren, the idea of you currently have power and that a lot of times, you know, dynamics of power feel very complicated and nuanced. And, you know, you think, well, how do I build power? And a lot of times, you know, you do already have power in your current positioning. It's just about, you know, determining what you're wanting to do, creating a plan, strategizing around that. You know, community organizing is a lot about strategy. And you can bet your butt that on the other end of the spectrum, people are organizing against equity, against freedom and liberty for all, right? Maybe it's only for some. And so the organizing's happening over there. And it's just that the ability to think about it in terms of what power do I have? What are my power and privilege platforms? And then how can I activate it in my everyday life? You know, I love telling the story. A lot of people haven't heard about Claudette Colvin. She was actually the kind of original Rosa Parks. So she learned about, she was a Black girl who's, I think, was maybe 15 years old. She learned about her constitutional rights in school and was on a bus and was asked by a white woman to give up her seat. And she said no. And the police were called. She was put in prison. Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., and a lot of other activists actually came, bailed her out, had a letter writing campaign. But she was the one who was the catalyst that then inspired Rosa Parks to do the same thing. And we don't even hear about that as a 15-year-old girl.
15.
And so like the power
Claudette.
That our,
go Claudette.
Yes, I know, right? And that story isn't told. And so you know, the power that we have as women, as just community members, we all have different types of power and privilege platforms. So, you know, anytime we have decision-making power, regardless of the environment or industry, you know, the lens that we apply to that decision can either perpetuate oppression or really work to dismantle it. And so, and when you think about it, like the structures that we're seeing, the systemic racism, the systemic oppression overall that we're seeing really it exists because of people's decision-making over time. And so if we think about power and decision-making in our everyday lives, we end up cultivating so much more than what we have when we think about ourselves as just kind of consumers of that versus our intentional actors in that kind of activation and agitation. And I think, you know, to kind of piggyback off of the original question, I think that it's so great that you even asked this about like, how do people get involved? How do they feel empowered to do so? Because so many women and people in general want to get involved. Just, you know, you don't really know where to start. And so I think one of the important things also to do is I encourage listeners to really connect with their own why. You know, their why do I want to be involved in this? What is your own kind of personal mission statement and passions? And then start to seek out education and resources that align with what you're already organically interested in. You know, if you have that deeper connection, it's going to just fuel your activism and your motivation to keep going and keep fighting against those oppressive systems when you have that personal deep-felt connection. Definitely, that's an incredibly important piece of that. I think ongoing learning is incredibly important. You know, I think as we'll continue, I'm sure, to talk about social justice and how it relates to kind of body autonomy and liberation. But I think that it's incredibly important when thinking about anything from a social justice perspective to also recognize the importance that history plays in it. And how we not only have been influenced by history, but we've been told, we've been fed a totally false, non-inclusive narrative of our country's history. You know, I think that it's important to recognize that there's a lot, like structural racism, enslavement, genocide is in our country's DNA. And if we don't know how we got here, how the disparities that we're seeing were created intentionally, then we can't really work to correct those disparities. And so that's one of the things that's really important for us as an agency is to advocate for equity on the path to justice, knowing that we have really a long road of correcting disparities and systemic oppression before we can reach that justice place.
Just like pause.
I mean, damn, Caroline.
Pause and take it all in. Everything you just said, I was just like, damn, like, yes.
Both of you. That was, I mean, my God, there's so many things.
There's so many things. And I think it's important to also say that, like, you know, there's like body, like we want to talk right about how, like, how body liberation is a part of social justice, you know, and it is like, and I mean, I've benefited from thin white privilege my whole life, right? Like, sure, I've had body dysmorphia, eating disorders, I've had my struggles, but like, I have never been oppressed by our culture, right? Like, my body has, you know, the world's designed for my body, like all of that. But, and so I know the reality though of you know, the oppression of larger bodies, right? And then of course of non-white bodies and like all of that. And so it's like this work, you know, and Health at Every Size framework actually is a social justice movement showing that, hey, body diversity is real. It is not okay that people go to the doctor, for instance, you know, and there aren't blood pressure cuffs for them and they are judged and they're just told to lose weight and they're not actually being seen as a patient, you know, and these very real ways that people are oppressed based on their body size, you know, let alone all the other different, you know, identities that are also oppressed and all those different, you know, things. And so I just think it's important that we bring to light, right, that like this work with even like body image can seem like, oh, just body image, but it's like, no, like this actually is us again, like calling out this system, because body size is just another way that we've been taught to rank people, right, as like better or worse, just like, you know, racism, right? It's like, it's another way that we're, that we've been taught and ingrained, and like, oh, well, thinner people are better, like they're the best, you know? And and it's when we can actually acknowledge that, that we can then begin to, I love what you were saying, make choices. Like let's start to make choices in terms of what are we buying into? What are, like, what systems of oppression are we upholding? And I know, like, when I talk to my clients and we'll do, like, body image work, I always bring this up. I'm like, okay, so that thought, all the compassion you have, this, like, negative thought because it's just programmed into you, but let's look at what that thought is. Let's look at where that thought comes from and like the systems of oppression that that thought is like supporting. And then like, do you want to support that? Right. And they're always like, no. And it's like, when we can recognize the power of these thoughts and like what even just like body image thoughts and all these things and the weight stigma and the fat phobia that they produce. Whoa, right? Like we realize, oh, damn. Like, and this is where when you're talking, like find your thing. I'm like, this is our thing, right? Like this is what we feel really passionate about. Yeah.
That was that was what popped out to me so much, which you were talking about, Caroline, of like finding your why. Like what's your why is literally a question that I ask because it's true. Like I found my way into every bit of the work that I do now because I started trying to unlearn my own belief system that was upholding fat phobia and that was upholding this system of oppression that I had very much bought into and had experienced in my life. Like I have gone to doctors and been not taken seriously because of the size of my body. I've gone to stores and been told nothing here will fit you. I have that small bit of experience, but my why was really that I was like, I have to understand how this lives in me so that I can like talk to anybody else about it at all. And I do see, you know, like I'm an artist, but I use my work very much to like help other women like find that power, understand that you actually have this power inside of you all along. And it can seem very like, you know, body positivity and all this can seem like a very like soft thing to like come home to yourself. And I talk about finding your magic and feeling connected to yourself, but it really is so much bigger than that. It's so much more about understanding that diet culture, this how many billion dollars a year industry.
72 and counting. Not including the wellness industry or the beauty industry.
Right. I knew you would know that. I knew you would know the number. But billions.
It's growing, probably 80 billion. Yeah.
Billions and billions of dollars a year that these people are profiting off of us upholding this belief system, upholding this ladder of like putting the thin ideal up at the top. And it is really important for us to understand that like the work that we do when we unlearn these things in ourselves and when we're able to help others unlearn them about themselves is dismantling a system of oppression. It's a lot bigger than just learning to love your stretch marks.
Right, exactly. Like that critical thinking and the questioning that I think in terms of like a theme for this episode, that like unlearning thing is definitely so huge because you have to unlearn and then relearn a whole new set of kind of practices and, you know, intentionality. And I think that that is something that's been so important in anti-racism work is that as humans, we have grown up in a culture that upholds white supremacy. And it gives centuries of advantage to some groups and disadvantage to other groups. And, you know, when you're thinking about it in terms of anti-racism, like you can be a socially conscious, kind person and still understand and accept the fact that you have been saturated in structural racism. And that then that understanding of it allows you some freedom to then not only challenge those systems in the ways that you enable them to persist, but gives you the freedom of self-expression and like really getting to know who you are at your core, independent of some of these other pressures and systems of oppression.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. It's the unlearning is so key, right? But we can only unlearn if we're willing to actually confront it, right? We can only unlearn it if we're willing to actually say, oh shit, there's internalized racism in me. There's internalized fat phobia in me. Of course there is. Like, hello, it's the fucking air that we breathe, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, we you can't unlearn something if you're not willing to say that you have it, right? Like we have to own that and be like, okay, this is the ugly, you know, truth of the world that we live in and the country that we've been born into. And like, we have to do a lot of the work to unlearn these really awful, you know, implicit biases that we have.
And we have to, I think a lot of it is becoming comfortable with admitting that you were wrong, becoming comfortable with being uncomfortable. You know, I think the biggest thing is that there's something in the American way of like never admit that you were wrong.
Well, and we've seen that
even more so
with Donald Trump, right?
Like, right.
Most presidents in the past will have admitted when they were wrong, right? And they'd take responsibility, right? And what have we seen for the past 4 years? He will never admit he's wrong. He will not take responsibility.
And over 200,000 Americans
dead.
Right.
And so I feel like he's just an example of just how much we've like really latched on to our pride, you know?
Right. But mm-hmm. like I was saying, it's like you have to become comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable and admitting that you don't know everything and that there's still so much to learn. And especially, you know, like I am now a 30-year-old woman, like learning so much more about the fact that my education was very whitewashed and I did not have all of the facts. I didn't have a full understanding. And I, you know, it's like, fuck, I was wrong. I thought that I was doing a good job of being a person, but I can do a better job of being a person for all of the people around me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That accepting responsibility is a huge component of harm reduction, right? And, you know, we as white people have caused significant harm. And so it's incredibly important to accept responsibility, take ownership of your actions, and then really work to change those actions. And I think that that's another really important piece of engagement is that it can't just be unlearning and relearning new stuff. You have to apply it to action, right? You actually have to do additional work.
Yes. Absolutely. So what are ways that people can then get in action?
Sorry, Lauren, if you want to take this one too, I don't want to continue to chat.
No, I feel like we both have all of the things to say about this. So we'll bounce off of each other.
Tell them all.
Yeah, Lauren, let's hear it, Lauren.
Well, I think one thing right now that is very clear in the forefront of all of our minds is being politically engaged.
Election day is tomorrow. If you have not voted, this is your reminder to get your fucking ass to the polls.
If you haven't been listening to Julie and I every single day on every single platform we own, being like, go vote.
Yes. Yes. So I feel like right now, it's easy to be on that path, but it's a lot harder in like the middle of the year when there's no presidential election in sight to really be on that, especially locally. And I will be the first to say, like, I want to go to a whole new place with being consistently engaged and informed, but I have been talking to friends and family about it as in like, we need to make this a discipline of ours. Like we consistently exercise or we consistently try to get good sleep, you know, like devoting consistent time to being aware of what's going on in our cities around us. I think that's huge. We just had an event called Activists and Agitators. And Austin Channing Brown spoke and somebody asked her like, what do we do? she made a point that was like truly my favorite. She was like, we have to be nerds about this stuff. Like when it comes to us fighting for systemic change, like we have to get to a nerdy level of knowledge about what's going on. So I think like really like consistently trying to, stay educated about what's going on in our communities, how that's impacting social equity around us. Like, I think that that's huge. And there are definitely like resources that anyone can access. Like one of the great ones, I think, is the City of Columbus has a YouTube page. And
yes,
it's literally great.
They do.
What?
Yeah. And they post like all of the city council meetings. Yeah. They'll post like special meetings, your neighborhood commission meetings on there. And I'll look at them sometimes. It's literally like two views. I'm like, but this is like, we know exactly what our city is doing. And like when people in positions of power make like changes that are, you know, policy changes, like that impacts like those like social structures and those social determinants down the line. Like, and so it's very important that we can like kind of stay aware of that and be engaged too. Mm-hmm. Caroline, do you have any things as well?
Yeah. Well, I think that was really a great like starting off point in just to, I guess, pile a little bit of extra stuff on there. I think in terms of especially like YWCA's advocacy agenda, specifically YWCA Columbus, because we've got YWCAs all over the place. We're sprinkled everywhere. we really do focus a lot on housing justice as well. So as Lauren said, you know, attending your area commission meetings specifically to learn about new development happening in your neighborhood could be really helpful, especially around zoning. So, you know, when residents are considering projects for coming into your communities, you sometimes might hear pushback about some, you know, a new development might bring in crime, quote unquote, or, you know, changing the look of the neighborhood, things like that. Those really could be red flags of bias. And, you know, if you're interested, especially in housing justice and how things like redlining were designed specifically to marginalize communities of color, and even seeing how right now the digital divide that we're experiencing are significantly in those same redlined neighborhoods. So if those are things that are interesting to you, you know, go to, there's a great 18-minute video called Segregated by Design. I'd highly recommend watching that if that's an interest of yours. But like as far as Lauren's mentioned about being more politically informed too, you know, of course, we're going to tell you to vote. If you are somebody that has access to the privilege of voting, you know, please do so. Vote early. Vote in all elections. Local elections especially are ones that help to determine policing reform. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that's on our advocacy agenda this year is passing the resolution to adopt a civilian review board. So we highly encourage everyone to vote yes on issue 2 so that we can establish that review board. That is a really great step forward in far as just like community and policing relations and accountability specifically. Those are definitely things that we would encourage you to consider. Also, even if you're voting, research judges and prosecutors. Like there That's are right. so many different things. Yes, you know there are so many different layers of power that are embedded into our political systems beyond just thinking about voting for your state representative and the president, your mayor. You know, there's a lot of additional opportunities to really create substantial change, but it takes work. You know, so sometimes people don't want to vote on a judge sometimes because it doesn't have a D or an R next to it on the ballot, and so you're like, well, I don't know what to do, so I'm just not going to vote for someone. Take that time to do your research. Yeah. And then also engage with your legislators. I think that, you know, as we're talking about, and we've kind of mentioned this before, but as we're talking about the idea of how body liberation connects to social justice as a whole, you know, obviously a woman's right to control her own reproductive and sexual health comes to mind. Is a big piece of that that's, you know, also potentially at risk right now. But I think that it's really important to think about as we're approaching disrupting oppressive systems, it's incredibly important to address issues of intersectionality, right? So people with co-occurring marginalized identities experience and encounter significant barriers to body liberation from colorism and the exotification of Black and Latinx women to, you know, like we talked about before, the racist white-centered norms about, you know, hair and texture, to even like transphobia and how class and financial privilege impacts gender expression and the kind of respect that other people are given when they are, again, perceived to have a particular identity that maybe doesn't align with their own internal feelings. And so I think that it's really important to consider not just your own personal relationship with body liberation, but what other kind of layers of barriers exist for other groups, and really calling that out and providing a platform to center those marginalized groups in the conversation, right? So for us at YWCA, having and centering voices around like Black women, Black queer women, as we're thinking about developing strategies towards a collective liberation, it's incredibly important to not just have the people sitting around the table and who have a voice at the table look the same and have the same experiences, because you're going to have a very kind of one-track solution that only works for those who have similar experiences and identities.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Well, and I mean, even thinking about it in terms of body liberation from a historical perspective, again, that genocide and enslavement that comes along with it. And so we have to ask ourselves, like, what does true body liberation look like for people whose physical and emotional safety is always at risk, right? So yeah. The structural racism that we see today impacts the life outcomes and body autonomy of our Black and Brown neighbors who, you know, disproportionately experience violence, mass incarceration, premature death. So that is literally the antithesis of body liberation.
Right.
And so how can we be intentional accomplices to not just center our own stories and advance issues for our own kind of well-being, but really carry that forward into other people as well?
Drop mic.
I mean, what else do you all need, listeners?
I know.
If that doesn't fire you up to want to fucking do something, I don't know what will.
Seriously. We are so grateful to have you guys on today.
Oh my goodness.
Let's do our final question.
Yes. Thank you both so much. I am so fired up right now. So we always like to end the podcast with the same question, which is, if you could talk to your younger self at any point, what is one thing that you wish that she knew?
Lauren, you want to go first?
Sure. But before I answer, I just want to say, too, we have an awesome resource guide that you can find on our webpage if you want even more details of, like, how you can get educated, get activated.
Yes.
And voter guide. So
we'll
check us out.
In our show notes.
Yeah. It can all be in the show notes.
Great. Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hell yeah.
Well, I think I would tell my younger self, I've been trying to think about this question since you guys sent it to us, the best way to say this, but I think I would tell my younger self to not just accept what's presented to me, to like really dream big, and that like you can like live a life of gratitude while still dreaming big and wanting more. I think I think I really wanted to be like a happy, content, grateful young woman, especially because I feel like I had a lot of privilege in comparison to the way my parents grew up. So, you know, I was like, listen, my life's great. And it was great, but I think when you focus too much on like, I should be grateful, then it doesn't give you a lot of space to dream for what you could be and what could be. So I would tell my young self, like, you can live in both of those worlds where you're really grateful, but you also dream for more.
Yes, it's both and.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Multiple truths.
I love that so much.
So fucking much.
So much.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think you're right. Like, there's so much that we do about like comparative traumas, right? That we think, I shouldn't feel like this because so many other people have it way worse. And in reality, like, you can validate your own experiences, still be grateful for the fact that you have what you have or that you are who you are. But yeah, I love that idea of being grateful, but still dreaming big and wanting more for yourself and for others. And to give yourself some forgiveness in even like that idea of how you might have some caution around that, and to just say, you know, it is okay, but it still means that we can continue to dream big. So I love that, Lauren. I think for me, you know, I'm trying to think about how to. I want to be kind to my younger self, because sometimes I look back and I want to just give myself a gentle throttle and be like, what were you doing? Why were you doing that? Why were you there? You know, so that I could have made maybe some safer decisions. But I also really recognize that a lot of that kind of like pain that I sometimes maybe went through when I was younger, like really shaped me into who I am and allowed me to recognize what I would allow other people, how I'd allow people to treat me, like what I know that I deserve, and to really be able to trust my intuition and my sense of self. And so I think that, you know, on the one hand, maybe a small gentle throttle would still be warranted in certain circumstances. but I think overall, I would tell her that you are enough, that you are worthy of self-love, and that, you know, the motivations that drive you to be, to allow yourself to feel that kind of internal motivation instead of caring more about what other people think. Because, you know, you do get to a certain age, and although, you know, I don't think it ever fully goes away, at least for me, you know, getting out of my 20s and feeling like, not that I had arrived, because you've never arrived, right? But I think that, you know, you get to a certain point where you're kind of like, why do I care? Like, who are they? Like, who are these people that I'm supposed to be pleasing? And like, especially if it's impacting my own sense of like well-being, like, who gives a shit? So, so I think just like, you know, believing in self, that you're worthy, and that, you know, feeling it attuned to what feels right to you, you can trust.
Mm. Oh, I love that so much.
Mm. You guys, you rocked your very first podcast ever.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you right now.
I forgot this was your first ever podcast appearance, because you both just crushed it.
Oh, thank you. This has been so much fun.
Yeah. I am so grateful for you guys sharing your time and your wealth of knowledge and passion with us and our listeners. Tell us, or tell them. So we're going to definitely link the resource guides in our show notes. And then where else can they find like you guys, or learn more about YWCA, or how they can get involved in their own communities?
Yeah. Right off the bat, they can certainly go to our website, which is ywcacolumbus.org. I'll let Lauren talk about our link tree, because I am not quite as technologically understanding or savvy as she is about that piece. But that's one thing. You can find a lot of information about what we do and get involved. Fill out that application if you're interested in the Leadership for Social Change program, or if you're somebody who has, if you are a caregiver for a girl in middle school and you want to get her involved in Bright Futures, all that information is on our website. But I will do a quick plug also that if you are somebody who you're like, my employer or this group that I'm a part of, they need to do better. We are officially announcing our expanded diversity, equity, and inclusion training and consulting services as well. So we're going to be going into organizations, corporations, nonprofits, you know, neighborhood groups, and really trying to provide substantial, not only racial equity training, but like diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting work for organizations. So, you know, that is just kind of one small piece of the puzzle. But I think that any time that we can be making strides in the right direction, it's incredibly important and helpful. So definitely check out our website if you're interested in continuing your own education as well. And then Lauren, tell us about the link tree for more social justice specific stuff.
This is just me trying to be hip with the youths.
I feel you.
Giving up a link tree. No, you can go to linktree.com/YWCA CBUS Social Justice, and that's linktr.ee. And it has a bunch of links for how the lots of different resources. We've been making videos lately on things that are going to be on the ballot. So the Civilian Board Review issue 2, we're talking about why you should pay attention to who we're putting on our school board and why you should pay attention to the prosecutors and all that kind of jazz. So you can find our resource guides behind those videos on the link tree. And yeah, voter guide, everything like that. I'm trying to think of like any other resources.
This sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And if you think of more after the ep, just email us and we'll put it all in the show notes. You know,
it's that easy. Pop them in there.
Yeah. Pop them on in.
Pop them on in.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was such a wonderful episode with you guys. We're so grateful for you both, and especially grateful for all the amazing work that you are doing in our community to create such important change.
Well, we are endlessly grateful for you both as well. And again, thank you so much for using your platform to advance change in areas that you care about. So you're already doing the amazing work that we've been talking about today. So thank you too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. And if you are listening on Monday, the day that this episode drops, and you have not yet, go vote.
Go vote.
Go vote.
Go vote.
All right. Thanks. We love you. Bye. Thanks so much for tuning into another episode of The Babes Mint.
We hope you're feeling a little more at home in your body and inspired as hell.
If you are ready to change your relationship with your body and yourself, we're here for you.
Snag a goddess session with Steph.
Or check out Jules' free masterclass to free yourself from diet culture for good.
The links are on our website to learn more and sign up.
And of course, if you loved this episode, we'd so appreciate it if you spread the love a little bit.
Share the app.
Rate the show.
Leave a review.
Subscribe.
You know what to do.
It's 2020.
Until next time.
Thanks. We love you. Bye.